Fasten your seatbelts and turn up your radio. We're going on a road trip.
Here comes the sun, I say, it's all right.
With sunshine and warmer temperatures finally arriving in north central Wisconsin, the trees are sprouting their leaves, and many of us are dreaming about a summer filled with fresh, homegrown produce and an array of gorgeous flowers in our backyards. Interest in gardening soared during the pandemic, more than 50% nationwide, and more people than ever are taking their green thumbs for a test drive. But living in this climate with its short growing season has its challenges for even the most experienced gardeners. Welcome to Route 51. I'm Shereen Seward. Today, it's our annual foray into gardening with tips for best practices and answers to your gardening questions, all to help you make the most of the growing season. Whether you're putting together your very first garden or have years of experience, you'll come away with fresh ideas and inspiration for the spring and summer months ahead. Joining us today are two gardening experts to offer their advice and answer your questions. Nick Schultz is a Portage County Master Gardener. She has written extensively about gardening topics. Nick, welcome back to Route 51.
Good morning. Great to be here, Shereen.
Also joining us today, Marissa Ashbeck, Horticulture and Grounds Manager at Monk Botanical Gardens in Wausau. Marissa, thank you for being here today as well.
Thank you for having me. Good morning.
We invite you to join the conversation and then ask our experts about your specific gardening challenges. You can call us at 800-780-9742. You can email questions to route51@wpr.org. When calling, please allow enough time for our producer to answer your call. Okay, let's start with the temperatures we're seeing in north central Wisconsin. We were spoiled. We had a few 80-degree days, right? Then things changed. It got cold again. We had freeze warnings as early as this week. So, Nick, is it finally time to start planting, or should we wait for Memorial Day? When's a good time?
Well, actually, the 10-day forecast looks like it is time to plant. The best guidance is always to wait till Memorial Day for the vegetables that are tender. But we are already, I did a quick check of the growing degree days, which is what we measure for temperatures above 50 degrees, which is kind of the magical period. And we are way ahead of last year. Just under the 30-year average for central Wisconsin. So we're in good shape.
Well, that's good to know. The USDA classifies locations in these hardiness zones. So what does that mean in a practical sense? And like for us here in northern and central Wisconsin, Marissa, what is our hardiness zone? What thrives here? What should we look for?
Yeah, right here in central Wisconsin, we are in zone 4. So you want to look for plants. Anything in zone 4 is going to be a perennial. So it's going to come back from year to year in our climate. So anything below zone 4 is going to survive here. Anything above zone 4, like zone 5, zone 6, they might make it in kind of covered areas or protected areas, but they might not make it through our winters. So a lot of your annuals or bedding plants, vegetables, things like that, aren't going to survive our winters or those cold temperatures, and you're going to have to replant them from year to year. So stick to that zone 4 around us.
Okay, good to know. As we mentioned, there are so many people new to gardening during the pandemic. A lot of people tried it for the first time. What's the lure, Nick? What are new gardeners gravitating toward?
So because of the pandemic, we were all encouraged to stay home and spend time outside. So I think that is largely why people took to gardening. It was also safer than perhaps going to the grocery store. And that is exactly why vegetables were a key component of that increased interest. So it was interesting. Not only were more people doing vegetables, but the demographic that was most of the increase. So the 50%, it went from 42 million nationwide to 63 million. Most of that increase was men under 35.
Okay, so interesting
demographic, and they're growing vegetables. That's been a trend even before the pandemic, that the local foods movement continues to be strong.
Interesting. I can say that when I look at my backyard, it's hard for me to know exactly where a garden should grow. I mean, where do you place it? Marissa, what are some things to keep in mind when you're choosing a site for a vegetable garden? Where should it go?
So basically, a lot of your vegetables are going to need a whole lot of sunlight. So wherever you have the most sunlight, because if you're going to have a partially shady location, you're going to have vegetables kind of stretching out. They might not have the produce set that you want. You might have different insect and disease issues as well, because those plants start drying out as well as they should be either. So if you can have a site where there's like 6 hours of sunlight or more, that is the best site you can have. Then look at your different soil types as well when you're looking for your site, whether you're tilling right into the ground or you're creating a raised bed. You're going to have some differences there on what you need for soil. But if you have a really sandy soil, you might have to amend it with some peat moss or something like that. Or if you have a really rocky soil, you might have to bring in some topsoil or compost or something for that as well. So usually on your southern exposures, your western exposures, and then think about where your water source is as well. Sometimes we forget about that. And if we have a raised bed, if you don't have a water spigot on that side of your house, you're going to have to truck water over to that. Sometimes it's not as fun, and you want to just think about that as well. And just the closeness to your house as well. If it's further away, are you going to visit your garden as much? That's something to consider as well. Because if it's off somewhere in the distance, you might not pay attention to what's ripening and producing.
You mentioned soil, and I guess, does it matter what kind of soil based on what you're growing, or is there just a magic recipe of soil that works for everything?
Yeah, for the soils, basically, the vegetables really love like a nice loamy soil with a lot of organic matter in it. Most veggies don't like that hard, kind of rocky, very compacted soil, so you want a nice, light and fluffy soil. Some sand really helps, like carrots and root crops really love sandy soil because they can just dig their roots down and they just keep on growing and growing really easily, versus a compacted soil, they're not going to grow as long for you. So anything with a lot of organic matter, getting those nutrients. So basically, when you think of organic matter, leaf compost, peat moss, any sort of additive, you know, organic matter you're adding in there, the nutrients stick to that organic matter, and that's what's feeding, and it makes it available to your vegetables. So the more you have, the better it is.
Okay. And I do want to touch on something that you mentioned, raised beds. I feel like raised beds are kind of the thing right now. Everybody's looking at those. What about vertical plantings and straw bale gardenings? I mean, we're hearing a lot of focus on these things. What are some of the pros and cons of these types of gardens to consider before starting, especially if I'm new at this?
Yeah, so definitely. So there are so many different varieties. So raised beds, usually they're right above the ground and they're using either cedar. You want to just be careful with any treated wood that you're using. Put like a liner in it so nothing is seeping into your soils as you're going along. And then you can build it up as high as 2 feet if you want, if you have the right supports with those raised beds. You can buy smaller self-watering raised beds if you want. They're usually plastic or poly, some sort of like that. And they have legs on them for smaller spaces. Mm-hmm. So you can definitely use those as well. Either way, just you're not going to be able to produce as much, let's say, because you're having smaller areas for gardening or square footage, basically. Mm-hmm. You know, you're not going to be able to put 4 tomatoes in a small raised bed that's on legs on your deck, let's say. That's going to be kind of a stretch. So you've got to really think about your size of your plants and how much produce you actually need. Because with straw bale gardening, it's a type of raised gardening or vertical gardening. You're bringing in those vertical bales And you are adding in kind of composting it basically before you plant. You're adding in all sorts of good nutrients, kind of brining them, and then you're planting in them. And basically then you can use that as compost the next year, let it break down by itself. So that is another way of doing it, but you'll need new straw bales just about every year because they do break down. And any vertical gardening, like pallet gardening, is just fine. Just be aware, the smaller the container, the more you're going to have to water it. So if you are doing the pallet gardening where you lay a pallet down, you have about, I'd say, 4 or 5 inches of soil in there, it might dry out a little quicker. Your plants might not be as big as they would normally be in a pallet garden because of that reduced root area.
Nick, what are some of the must-have garden tools? What if I'm a new gardener, what should I have at the ready before I start?
Okay, if you are new and working the ground, I think you'll want to make sure you have a spade and a hoe. If you are doing containers, you could probably get by with a trowel, although that would be a lot of digging with your trowel. There's a tool that I like to use a lot called a hori-hori. It's I think I'm saying it right. It's like a knife, a long knife that has, so you can dig into the ground and dig up roots, and there's a serrated edge that is just a nice all-purpose tool. And then either a claw or a rake to cut through some of the other sinks. So those are probably the most important. And then it's ongoing as you're gardening throughout, a good scissors or little snips or pruners that are all and invest in high quality if you want to continue gardening. You'll get much more satisfaction out of your gardening efforts.
And Nick, since we're talking about beginning gardening, what are some of the easiest to grow vegetables for first-time gardeners that you're not going to get completely frustrated with? What would you recommend?
Yeah, I would say lettuce, radishes are so easy. Peas and children, the peas and corn are really good for kids because the seeds are big enough that they can plant them. Beans, certainly. I mentioned corn, but do that one only if you have the space for it and you don't have raccoons in your neighborhood because they'll take care of it. But there's so many. Whatever you like. Tomatoes are easy to grow, and cucumbers, they need a little more space, but you can do anything you like. And if you're doing it from seeds, it's very inexpensive. Things like peppers and some tomatoes at this time of year, you probably want to buy the plants, at least small plants, to get to kind of get a jump on it.
Lots of delicious things grow on vines, that's for sure. Squash, pumpkins, tomatoes, runner beans. How can I keep those vines from taking over my garden? Marissa, this is a problem that we've heard about from friends who say, you know, I planted this squash and it was just everywhere. So is vertical gardening the answer? What do you recommend?
Yeah, and when you are choosing your varieties, you want to really think about the space that you have. Look at those beautiful pumpkins that you're planting. They might stretch like 20 feet a plant. So you're like, oh my goodness, what is happening in here? They're all tangled up. You want to consider, yes, vertical gardening. So anything you can create a trellis with, whether it's an old metal frame that you're putting up with some fence posts, or if you take sunflower stalks from last year, you can create grids and different trellises and things like that. Any hoops, like metal wire hoops, you can use. They do have like bean pole trellises as well. Let them climb up. You can also try sister gardening as well. Nick had talked about planting your corn and maybe some squash and some maybe pole beans or something like that, or runner beans. They will act as sisters and they grow. The squash and the beans grow up onto that corn stalk, and you're saving room that way. And you can pick right off of that by using that vertical growth habit, and it's easier to pick as well.
So it sounds like giving them a place to go is the way to keep them from going where you don't want them to go. So great advice there. Nick Schultz and Marissa Ashbeck, our guests today on Route 51, our annual gardening program. When we return, we'll talk about flowers and trees. Later in the program, we'll hear some tips on pest control, too. Your questions are welcome. Join us by calling 800-780-9742. You can also email your questions to route51@wpr.org. When you call, please allow enough time for our producer to answer your call. I'm Shereen Seewert. This is Route 51 on Wisconsin Public Radio.
Here's a hymn to welcome in the day, heralding a summer's early sway, and all the bulbs all coming in to begin. The thrush's bleating battle with the wrens disrupts my reverie again.
See that watermelon hanging on the vine? I wish that watermelon could be mine. The farmer must be careless without a lick of sense, or he wouldn't leave it hanging on the vine. Cornbread is sweet, pork chops are good, black-eyed peas are mighty, mighty fine. But give me, oh give me, I really wish you would, that watermelon hanging on the vine.
We're back on Route 51. I'm Shereen Seewert. Marissa Ashbeck and Nick Schultz are guests today on Route 51. It's our annual gardening program. We'd love to hear your questions, too, whether you've had years of experience or you're just starting out. What are your biggest gardening challenges? You can email us at route51@wpr.org or join us by phone at 800-780-9742. When calling, leave enough time for our producer to answer your call. Marissa, you work in Wausau, so you may be familiar with the city's southeast side where I live. Lots and lots of trees there, which we love, but it makes for a pretty shady yard, and that brings some significant challenges. What are some of the best perennials for shady yards, like people in our neighborhood that struggle with that, especially if you want to add some color? Is there much to consider?
Yes, there are. Don't you worry if you have a shady yard. There are so many, I think, underutilized perennials for the shade. I actually love shade perennials kind of more than sun perennials in some instances. So what you can look for, pulmonaria or lungwort. It's a spotted little kind of fuzzy leaf, and it has beautiful little purple and pink bell flowers on it. And the deer hate it. So hopefully you can use that one as well. Also, astilbe are great as well, and they can kind of go into your sun areas as well. They have a plume, usually pinks and kind of burgundy reds and whites. So those are great. And they have like a fern kind of looking foliage to them. Great moundy plant and great size too, about 18 to 24 inches usually. Then you've got a variety of ferns that you can use too. Whether it is more of your native ferns, like your cinnamon ferns, sensitive ferns, stuff like that, or you can go towards like Japanese painted ferns or ostrich ferns. So you've got some really good options there. Ligularia, or it's called ragwort or bottle rocket sometimes. It's almost got a lily pad leaf on it with a yellow flower, whether it looks like a bottle rocket kind of spike flower or some that look like a daisy as well. You can also use pulmonaria or Jacob's ladder. There's variegated and green versions. They have a beautiful purple flower on them. And then what else do we have? Nick, do you have any suggestions?
I'm nodding all along because you're giving some great ones that I think are so useful. One other one that I like a lot is the Heuchera family. It's coral bells, and they need at least part sun, but can do pretty well in shade. And they have just tiny spires of flowers, but they look good all year long. You can get different colored foliage or different patterns in the green foliage. So we want to look for flowers, but we also want something to look good even when it's not flowering. So that's a good one for, and let's see,
if we, the harebells, campanula, some of those are good for shady gardens as well. Epimedium, blooming right now, gorgeous, heart-shaped flower in springtime. Another one, you're going to have to cut me off because there's so many, but the hellebores are, so Lenten rose and Christmas rose, gorgeous blooms.
How about the sunny yards? Of course, there's plenty of sunny yards in the area. So what are some of the best perennials to add some color for sunny yards?
I can start on that. I look for things that that have a long bloom time and also look good even when they aren't blooming. So some of the longest bloomers are also our native plants. The purple cone flowers, Rebecca, black-eyed Susan, in other words, have a long bloom time. Sedum, especially the autumn joy in fall, is really a good one. Peonies, my favorite. That's really a nice one that looks good. It blooms in June when a lot of things are just coming up and then it continues to look great in a like a shrub form almost. Liatris is another perennial purple. Those who think they love purple loosestrife, that's a great substitute for that bright purple color. Melissa,
yeah. So you are going along with all those great sun perennials. If you've seen allium or ornamental onions, they're like a purple little lollipop that you can plant either the bulb version or the perennial version in your yard. Those are booming in popularity right now. Also Shasta daisies. So those white little daisies with the yellow centers in them are great. You can get a 3-foot version or you can get like an 18-inch little version that creates a cute little carpet within your gardens. Also like black-eyed Susans. There's large varieties and small varieties and they love, love, love sunlight. And one other one I'll mention is Bee Balm or Monarda. It's actually the National Garden Bureau has the year of the Monarda this year. So really enjoy that Bee Balm and plant some for our friendly little pollinators.
Marissa, talk to me about the idea that I should group decorative plants in threes. I've heard that. Is that a thing and why?
Yeah, definitely. So I have a degree in landscape design and management. So I know all about these special numbers that we're supposed to stick to. So basically, you want to think about planting in ones, threes, fives, sevens, and, you know, on. Using those odd numbers creates a better eye flow. When you use two, it's very symmetric and it's kind of like blocky, if you think about it that way. And it stops your eye in its tracks, basically. If you have a very square house, very symmetrical, go ahead and use those even numbers. But basically, it's all about your eye flow and keeping your whole experience flowing through the garden, basically. Because remember, nothing is symmetrical in nature. If you think about it that way, everything just is kind of willy-nilly and just going about itself naturally.
Nick, can I ask you about deadheading? Do I need to deadhead both perennials and annuals? What's the deal?
Yes, and it depends, right? So there are some that if you deadheading encourages blooming. So on Oni petunias, for example, for annual flowers, you will get more, and on perennials, you get some of the side shoots by deadheading after they're done. So yes, that's if you don't do it, the plant isn't going to die. You just get a lot more flowers if you cut off that leader, and then you get the two side branching. So they're much fuller. There's some I mentioned Liatris earlier. If you cut that one off, it's done, right? So there's certain ones you just don't necessarily need to do. So okay, so how do you know which ones? Often on the when you're buying plants, especially annual bedding plants, it'll say no need to deadhead. Okay, don't, right? And on perennials, to make sure that we continue to love gardening and not have it just, you know, be the master of our summers. It's a good idea to pick a mix of things. If you love delphinium, for example, that's pretty high maintenance for staking and all kinds of other reasons, and deadheading doesn't really matter there. But then just make sure you have some things like geranium or the perennial geranium. It's a Cranesville. That doesn't need to be deadheaded. And things like that will help you focus on the, giving maybe a third of your plants the attention that are high maintenance and then enjoying the others.
It's our annual gardening show. Your questions are welcome. You can call 800-780-9742 or email us at Route51@WPR with your questions for our experts, Nick Schultz and Marissa Ashbeck. Marissa, you were saying that you have a lot of experience in landscaping, and I guess a question is, what's the best way to border plant beds next to grass? Now, pavers and decorative edging, that's one thing, but I've also heard trenching is a good idea. What do you recommend?
Yeah, so you can definitely use trenching. So that's digging down between your grass and then your bed. So you're creating almost like a little moat, let's say, you're digging down deep enough to prevent the grass roots from growing into your beds, basically. Because grasses are rhizomatous a lot of the time, so they're growing and spreading from their roots. So that's what trenching is, basically, to prevent that grass and weeds or anything from moving into your beds. Alternatives from pavers and things like that. Some people use even wood slices, I've heard of, is coming back. Using more alternative natural things. You could use like your little field stones if you wanted, but it's all in how much you want to maintain this area. You know, you can keep on weeding it out if you want to keep that natural edge. Otherwise, there are like black poly edging where you dig it down deep enough that you can't even see it. And it's blocking those roots from coming into your garden. And aluminum edging as well is another option if you're not into brick pavers or natural stone as well.
Nick, people with limited space often go to the baskets or hanging plants, smaller container gardening. What are some of the best options for that container gardening that somebody can put on their small back patio, for example?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So if you're doing baskets, it's a good idea to do something that will trail on the sides of the basket. So it could be petunias, or there's a whole variety of smaller plants that in the petunia family that just bloom all summer long. And I think, you know, our summers are so short, we want to just keep getting that bloom time in. So it depends on sun or shade, again, for what you're doing. If you those plants will take a lot of sun. If you're doing a container that isn't of a basket, that is in more of a freestanding, depending on, maybe you want a little bit more height. There's kind of an old standby that you should have a thriller, a spiller, and a filler in your baskets. It doesn't have to be three. You could do all the same if you want, but by that they mean something that kind of spikes up and then also trails down over the container. There's so many different choices from the old standbys of geraniums to just a host of new fun plants. And if you walk through a greenhouse, it's probably probably a bigger challenge to limit your selections than to just say, well, I'm only going in for these three things. So pick what you like and think about the continuous bloom again.
Okay, thank you. Marissa, a number of communities in our area, Wausau, Stevens Point among them, have no-mow May initiatives. They're encouraging homeowners to avoid mowing their lawns for the month to create kind of a haven for pollinators. I will tell you that we are participating and our yard looks like a big old mess, but it's great for the pollinators. What's the benefit? And I mean, how do you, what is that doing by not mowing in May?
So basically, the initiative for No Mow May is leaving those weeds that you might normally chop the heads off of by mowing in May. Basically, what it's saying is leave those for the pollinators, because there might not be a whole lot. Now it is really blooming, like all the different trees are. But before that, there's not a whole lot blooming, and we need to feed those little pollinators and let them do their thing. So basically, if you leave your mowing deck, you can take off, you know, the hair of it, basically give it a little cut if it's getting way too out of hand. Just leaving it 3.5 to about 3 inches, you're going to leave a lot of those plants in your lawn that are blooming. You'll see a lot of purples and yellows and whites going on right now, maybe in your lawns if you just kind of let it be more natural. So a lot of things that are blooming in your lawns are your dandelions, of course. Mm-hmm. And then wood violets. Self-heal is another one. It's a prunella, or it's a purple flower usually. Some people have a juga kind of in their lawn. If you have Creeping Jenny, that might be blooming as well. So there's like these bee lawn initiatives that people are even seeding these seeds into their lawn to help the pollinators if they're not too keen on, you know, keeping just a green lawn with all of your grass. So basically, if you are like, this is getting a little overwhelming with the No Mow May, you can still mow it down, but just keep it at a higher length, about that 3.5 inches. So,
well, once the No Mow May thing is done, how short should grass be kept to keep a balance between, you know, encouraging this bee-friendly lawn and avoiding grass that's too tall and difficult to cut? Obviously, there's ordinances to keep in mind, but what's kind of the perfect length?
Yeah. Nick, go ahead.
Oh, so 3 inches ideally is the best year round. So 3 is 3.5 is fine. And part of the reason we're doing it that way is because if you cut it down too low, then you give the weed seeds more of an opportunity to grow than your grass. So 3.5, 3. If your lawn is 9 inches at the end of May, you might have to do a little bit more.
All right. Nick Schultz and Marissa Ashbeck, our guests today on Route 51 for our annual gardening program. When we return, some advice on controlling weeds and pests to avoid that garden damage. Your questions are welcome. Join us by calling 800-780-9742. You can email us at route51@wpr.org. I'm Shereen Seward. This is Route 51 on Wisconsin Public Radio. We're back on Route 51. I'm Shereen Seward. Marissa Ashbeck and Nick Schultz are our guests today on Route 51. It's our annual gardening program. We'd love to hear your questions too, whether you've had plenty of experience or you're just a beginner. What are your biggest gardening challenges? Email us at route51@wpr.org or join us by phone by calling 800-780-9742. Let's talk about weeds. I know they can be so hard to control. It's the biggest problem in my yard. A lot of cautionary advice against using those chemical-based herbicides to fight weeds. Nick, what are some natural solutions? Are there any that really work?
The best natural solution is hand picking. And I know that's probably not everyone's favorite, but if you can start early and identify weeds when they're just coming out, there's a great extension publication actually that shows that identifies both grass-like and other weeds just as they're emerging. There's there's one thought process that if you can get all your weeds pulled before 4th of July, you can really enjoy them the rest of your summer, right? So get them when they're small before they spread. So that's certainly tried and true. Don't disturb your soil too much. That is one way to prevent them from starting, because it's when we till soil that we stir up all those weed seeds. So if you can minimize the soil turning over, you'll minimize the weeds. And then in terms of specific products, you can use corn gluten. You can use malorganite, and those are that helps. It's kind of a fertilizer weed suppressant that is more organic. If you are going to use something that is not organic, just think about the time of day that you're applying it too, because you want to put anything on your lawn and your vegetables when pollinators are not around. So perhaps later in the day.
Later in the day. Okay, good to know. What does mulch have to do with weed management, or doesn't it? Marissa, is there a mulch variety that works better than others?
So basically, it's personal preference and how much you're going to be out in the garden as well. So I'm a tried and true, like, hardwood mulch kind of girl. I use it a lot in my landscaper foundation beds because it's just easy for me to maintain things. And usually about 2 to 3 inches kind of is your good range to be putting on. You don't want to heap it around your plants. And even if you get cedar mulches, it might deter some of those bad insects as well because of the smell. But remember, if you're adding any every year, just add a small little bit or just kind of rake it up and top dress it. But there are other alternatives that you can use as well. So you can use, there's cocoa bean mulch. If you've ever heard of that, it's using cocoa bean hulls. It smells like chocolate. So if you're kind of like around your patio, you want to try it out. It's a different experience. It's really lightweight, so if you can't lift those big bags, it's nicer to haul it around, basically. Plus, it smells like that chocolate. But one thing to note with that is it breaks down way easier than what a bark mulch is or a wood mulch is. So you're going to probably have to put some new stuff down every year, and it kind of just breaks down into the soil. And sometimes if we have a lot of rain or if you have irrigation going on it, it might produce some cute little kind of mushrooms on it because it is so rich in organic matter. Anybody can use pine needles as well. I know some people use even pine cones in their gardens as well as an alternative mulch too, or even straws and things like that. So just be aware if you are using more natural approaches to mulches, you want to consider where the source is coming from and are there maybe some weed seeds in it or something that could be lurking in there that you're not sure of.
Marissa, how do you know, though? I mean, like, what cues you that something might be a little bit off?
Yeah, so basically, like, if you're getting your bagged mulches and everything, it should technically be, like, pasteurized. Sterilized a lot of the time. Your bagged soil and mulches are usually sterilized by using heat pasteurization. And then if you're going to, like, a local place, or even if you're out gathering your pine needles, your pine cones, kind of look in the area. Are there a lot of weeds in there or in the surrounding area where weed seeds might have blown in? And try to keep it really close to home. You don't want to be getting it from somewhere that's far away that might be bringing in a whole new pest or weed seeds.
Okay, good to know. Nick, can you naturally plant morels or do they just naturally grow?
I believe they just naturally grow. It's the fungus in the soil that produces them. And it's a combination of the fungus and wet and the moisture of that it's generated. And Lucy, you may know more about this than me.
Yeah. So basically with morels and mushrooms, I'm not positive if I've ever seen any kits or anything through grower supply or any mushroom growers. You might want to check with some local more like farms and mushroom growers to see if they can get some spores, inoculant, basically brine that you could try to grow morels by yourself.
The number to call if you have questions for our guests and want to chat about your challenges, 800-780-9742. The email address, root51@wpr.org. Nick, how can I keep invasive plants from infiltrating my garden? What's the best practice here?
You know, once they're there, they're really hard to contain. So I guess I would go back to some earlier advice, and that is just really be on the lookout for them early on, and get rid of them. So know what they look like and know when they're blooming. For example, in Stevens Point, garlic mustard is blooming right now, and it's always very sad to see that on the edges of beautiful parks. But it's when it goes to seed after flowering that it just spreads by the thousands. So if you see one plant, pull it out. The same with things like Creeping Charlie, that I know has invaded a lot of lawns. Right now it's blooming, it's purple. It's because the energy in the plant is going to the flowers. Pulling it up might be one way to the roots are a little more susceptible to being pulled out right now. So catch it when you can. Know the neighborhood. If you're looking for houses, know the neighborhood that you're moving into, and keep an eye on the kind of care that's going on and what else might be going on in that neighborhood too.
Marissa, what about invasive insects? What's the best way to deal with that? I know we've had a tree in our yard that constantly gets these weird little bugs. What can we do about that?
So basically, again, be educated about what's going on in your area. Using the UW Extension pages for different, they'll send you notifications on different insects that might be coming in, and you can really do your research that way. So Japanese beetles have been an issue. The past few summers here, they've really moved in. They're a black metallic kind of round beetle. They have spots on them, on their little legs, and they skeletonize leaves, basically. So
yes.
When you are able to identify that bug, you know how to treat it or do your research then once you know it's identified. So basically with like those Japanese beetles, you'll be able to put out like these little traps with pheromones in them to get them to fly into the bag. You can take dish soap in a cup and you can just throw them in there with water, and you can kill them that way. Or there are different sprays that you can use, or you can use like Grub-X in your lawn to prevent the white grubs from hatching into those beetles. So basically, it's knowing what's there and how its life cycle kind of goes through in your yard. Is it flying in, or is it living its entire life cycle in your yard and overwintering? So that's kind of the best way to do it. Once you know what it is, then you know what spray to use or preventative measure, basically.
Earlier, we talked about some specific plants that deer don't like. And I'd like to bring that back. Deer in our area, they treat gardens like an all-you-can-eat buffet, right? So, Nick, what can I do to discourage deer? What are the best plants that I can put in my garden that deer will just stay away from?
Yeah, so the good news is there are a lot of options even for that deer do tend to stay away from. I mentioned peonies earlier. They tend to stay away from iris and astilbe. And I'm actually thinking of everything that I have in my garden because they do stay away. Bee balm, cup plant, that's a native, which and they tend to stay away from some other natives too, so another reason to consider those. Lungwort, as Marissa mentioned earlier,
So basically, to go along with that as well, if anything has a smell to it, if you can really smell it and you're like, ooh, that doesn't smell maybe not good to you, or it just has a pungent smell, they're going to stay away from that. Anything with like leathery leaves, really tough leaves, they usually stay away from. And then anything that has a fuzzy leaf or a pubescent like leaf to it, they call it. So tiny little hairs, they don't like to have that kind of on their tongue. So some examples of that are like the black-eyed Susan, where it has kind of prickles on it, if you think about it that way. Some of the euchras or coral bells that we had talked about kind of have those prickles in astilbia as well. So you'll see there's like this ongoing theme with these deer-resistant plants where they have that scent, that leathery leaf, and that fuzziness to them.
Okay, good to know. What can we talk about watering for a minute? This is always an argument in our house. I know that some plants need more water than other plants, but is there a general rule of when you should water, how much you should water? Marissa, what's the story there?
So basically, it's all in your sun exposure and your soil, basically. So, and with any pots, how big is your pot? Because the smaller the pot, the more you're going to have to water it. Think of that root zone drying out quicker because it has less area to hold that water. So basically, sandier soils, you might have to water every day because there's not a lot of organic matter holding that moisture into your soil. You might have to have irrigation on your lawns or, you know, in your gardens doing drip lines, stuff like that. But let's say you have more of a clay soil. You might not have to water very much because that those clay particles hold that water in pretty well. So basically, my kind of rule of thumb, if anything is newly planted, it's still establishing. And let's say you haven't had water in about a week. You haven't had any rain. I would say water it about 2 to 3 times a week. You don't want to water it too much because then you're going to kind of baby the plant and it won't spread its roots. So you want those roots to spread out and start establishing and start searching for water. You don't want it to just stay in its cute little kind of container area that it was in. So once you plant something, rough up those roots, make them and encourage them to spread outward and search for water.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Nick, seeds and vegetable plants were sold out in 2020 as people were, you know, as we talked about earlier, people were getting into gardening more. They were planting their own food. What can we expect this year? What are you hearing?
So I did check with a couple of the greenhouses in our area to see about their supplies. And they, because they experienced that last year, many of them do have more on hand. And they seem, at least so far, to seem to be doing well. Of course, before Mother's Day, most of the sales were flower-related and that hanging baskets and that sort of thing rather than vegetables. So that's certainly true. I do know that when I was buying seeds earlier and that I thought was in plenty of time, some of what I wanted was already gone in some places, not all. There's many choices to buy seeds. So if you find that is your experience, try something new, right? You don't ever let one particular variety limits you. Keep experimenting because that's what gardening is after all, right?
It is one giant experiment, that's for sure. Marissa, as a monk gardens expert, what is the most common garden question that you hear? What are people asking you the most?
Basically, just how to lay things out and like, how do I know it's plant is like fit for an area? That is like the biggest question I get when people come out, or if I, you know, answer questions for them. It's basically you have to look at your area and, you know, your sun exposure, your soil. Really, what size requirements are we looking at? You know, you want to look at your zone as well for your plant. So when you're planting, really look at those plant descriptions and do your research on your plants. because you want to know exactly how big that plant is going to get at maturity. It might be so cute right now in the, like a 4-inch or a gallon pot, and you're like, oh, I'll plant like 5 of these. Well, in reality, maybe you could only fit 2 in that area. So really research and do that, and look at your seasons of interest as well. If it's going to bloom in spring versus in summer, and you already have a ton of spring bloomers, you don't want to add another one to that area. Just consider all of those things when you're looking at a plant. Just take the time to do that research, and you will not regret it.
Thank you so much. That's all we have time for today on Route 51. I'm Shereen Seewert. I'd like to thank our guests, Nick Schultz and Marissa Ashbeck. Our producer is Joy Ratchkramer. Our executive producer is Rick Ryer. Rick is also our on-air producer today. Special music today from the Beatles, Tennessee Ernie Ford, the Decemberists, Katrina and the Waves, the Osmonds, Herb Alpert, and the Tijuana Brass. Thanks to John Altenberg for the Route 51 theme. You can hear the archive of today's program at WPR.org/Route51. Next week, a discussion on the juvenile justice system and efforts to introduce new therapies for young offenders. And in 2 weeks, we honor those who made the ultimate sacrifice for our country just before the nation marks Memorial Day. Until then, we're heading out of town. ¶¶